All right, so in our circle of reflections just now, some of the themes that came forward are around the like doctrinal or abstract or universal or theoretical idea of nonviolence, and then the, you know, on the ground or in the real situation of the world, you know, tactic or expression of that value, how we might bring that value into action. In my community and many communities right now in relation to the war in Gaza, there's been struggle and really passionate engagement around the concept of ceasefire, around a request for a ceasefire in the war. Because I'm American and the way the American press and the American left functions, this request for a ceasefire has in a certain way been largely directed toward Israel, partly because Israel is causing an extremely unbalanced amount of the harm in the current war, but also I think because the intent in a certain way of a demand for ceasefire among, you know, and the American progressive community, the intent is partly to influence our own government to then influence its ally Israel, where being an enemy of Hamas, they're not so much the target of our protest, even though I know many folks saying, like, of course ceasefire means both sides in any conflict, and the word has become heavily politicized. So I've been in conversations around there was a time when, like, you know, should we use that word? Who should use it? In what context is it appropriate? Should institutions be calling for it? You know, what does it mean for college students to ask their university to call for ceasefire, to use that word? There was a time when some of us who are teaching, we had conversations in community around, like, is it appropriate for us to call for a ceasefire as spiritual teachers or leaders? Should our major spiritual centers use the word ceasefire? And one of the reasons why, coming from the Buddhist framework around nonviolence, that I'm not completely at ease with the conversation about the word, like, should we use it, should we not use it, you know, is it partly because the question about, like, is it time to ask for a ceasefire? Is it appropriate to ask for a ceasefire? It's a completely, in a certain way, it's a non-Buddhist question, certainly. But as practitioners, it's also, in a way, it's deeper into a public or social argument or conversation than many of us have gone in our own practice. So there's some way that I've wanted, in myself at least, to step back to, you know, what feel to me in my own view of the world like first principles and go forward from there. And so for me, a first principle, being connected in my heart and my life as for a very long time now to the teachings of the Buddha, respecting those teachings as the deepest teachings for well-being that I've ever encountered in the world, I begin with, and it makes sense to my heart, to begin with the principle of nonviolence. So we've talked about this. It's one of the wise intentions that flowers out of wise view. And it's an intention in the spirit of renunciation. So renunciation is the quality of intending to not take more than we need in the world, intending really to simplify our material needs and our demands upon the world out of a fundamental compassion for other people and animals, other beings, a fundamental wish for other beings to get what they need. There's very much a consciousness of resources in the Buddha's understanding of renunciation, and that it's a profound medicine for the heart to decide to take only what we need, because doing so challenges the core, maybe ancient trauma, or we could just say defilement, the core poison of greed or grasping, of wanting more for myself, more safety, more comfort, more of what I want. And so in the same way that renunciation is the intent to override an impulse that's natural to our animal beings and to our nervous systems and to our communal, you know, selves, to want more for myself and more for my people, renunciation undercuts that. Renunciation is intimately tied to the Buddha inventing the monastic order, because if you are responsible for the well-being of others, like your family or your community or your tribe, let's say, you can't make the personal or individual decision to renounce. You know, oh, I'm going to live with only taking as little as possible, with a very, very simple, simple livelihood. Because doing so essentially means saying, I'm willing to experience discomfort out of the principle of making there be more for others, and the connection between letting go and the liberation of my heart. So I'm willing to do with less in order to liberate my own heart and to leave as much as possible for others, which is also liberating for my own heart. But I can't make that decision for anyone else. So renunciation is very difficult to make as a community. It takes a lot of meetings. It takes a lot of consent and collaboration to together make a decision to not take something that we could take, right? So in a global sense, for instance, it takes a lot of regulation and politics to convince, for instance, you know, an industrial nation to drill less or to burn less or to you know, take less of a resource that others could use. And in a sense, you know, modern borders are a way of preserving resources for one group and putting a wall up against another group. And so they are fundamentally not resonant with renunciation in a certain way. They are protective of resources in a certain way. And so nonviolence is, it's a child of renunciation. It's related to renunciation because it is an expression of the intention to not take more than I need. And so I'm not going to take more than I need by hurting someone else. I'm not going to break the precepts in a way. I'm not going to take someone's life or their property or their sexual energy in a way that causes harm. And so that's the basis of non-harming. One of the reasons I think it's really challenging in a real world political social conflict like the war in Gaza or civil rights in the U.S. historically, or the war in Ukraine, you know, many, most maybe. violent conflicts in some way swirl around possession of land, access to resources, and the encircling of a group of people with some kind of border, physical borders, but also identity borders, the borders of the definition of a group of people as family or tribe or community. And so there's a dissonance between the principle of nonviolence that is really a sibling to renunciation, and the world where we are interacting with and other people are interacting with each other who are not making an intention toward renunciation. Another way of thinking about this is that it's a Buddhist concept. It appears in other religions, right? The Quakers understood this. There are different threads of Hindu spiritual practice, yogic practice that understood this very deeply. Gandhi understood this very deeply. Tolstoy understood this very deeply. There's a deep tradition of folks finding their way here, right? There have of course been nonviolent Christian movements, nonviolent Jewish movements. But the way that I'm talking about it here is a specifically early Buddhist approach, thinking about it as part of wise intention. And Buddhism is a path that does want to spread itself. Like, there is the impulse within the Dharma to spread the teachings so that people can benefit from them and be free, be liberated by them. But it's not... it's not a moral system that is easy to impose on others in a kind of judgment way. Right? So partly what I mean by this is, if you are a person or a member of a group of people who are not Buddhist, not interested in renunciation, not connected to the theory that the Buddha brings forward, that letting go is the path to peace. That's not everyone's idea of the path to peace. Some folks' path to peace is to, you know, get a secure piece of land for my people and govern it well in a humane and, you know, secure way so that these people can be secure for a long time, right? That's a kind of identity or nation, people, tribal-based idea of security. Other folks' idea of security is other things, right? The Buddhist ideal is, it depends on this core theory that doing with less and letting go is good for the heart. But that only matters to you if you take that up. And if you don't, if you have a different view, for instance, then in a certain way, nonviolence is a poor tactic to propose from outside. So like, you know, as a privileged California, you know, Buddhist who loves the philosophy of this ancient tradition, and nobody is attacking my home, for me to either say to the Palestinian people from my, you know, my perch over here where no one's bombing me, that the Palestinian people should, you know, consistently for the last 50 years be protesting the Israeli occupation utterly peacefully, and then say, you know, to the Israelis that, you know, that their behavior in the region should be utterly peaceful, even though they feel themselves, they are surrounded by enemies, with all of the history that both of these peoples have of being subject to violence, You know, first of all, I have no standing to propose this, but also, it's not a universal principle. I might say, you know, if your goal is peace in your own heart, is liberation from greed, hatred, and delusion, liberation from suffering, in terms that we would recognize as Buddhist, you know, I want to uproot suffering from my own heart. If that's your goal, then maybe we could have a conversation around how a nonviolent response to the current situation will help that goal. But if your goal is something else, and this is not your philosophy, then nonviolence in a certain way is just a tactic. And nonviolence as a tactic in a social movement, the way Gandhi used it, the way the civil rights leaders and communities in the United States used it, the way various communities have used it over the over recent centuries. As a tactic, it's one tactic among many. I love it, not because I think it's the best tactic to achieve political ends. I think sometimes it's a helpful tactic, but there's lots of good tactics, some of them violent, to achieve a political or social end. I love nonviolence because it's a tactic to achieve a spiritual end. It's a tactic to achieve the end of suffering in the heart. And that's the level at which the Buddha advised folks around him. You know, when the Buddha says to Ajatasattu's minister, who has come to him to ask if it's a good idea to invade the neighboring Vajjian Republic, the Buddha doesn't answer, but he turns to Ananda, who is standing nearby, and says, Ananda, have you heard that the Vajjians meet regularly in a respectful way with each other and conclude their meetings with respect and kindness? And Ananda says, yes, they have. And the Buddha says, people who meet regularly and conduct their meetings with respect and kindness, it's hard to defeat them. And he says, Ananda, have you heard that these people respect their elders and take care of them? Yes, I have heard that. People who respect their elders and take care of them, it's hard to, they are likely to sustain and prosper for a long time. That's really what he said. He doesn't say it's hard to defeat them. He says they are likely to sustain and prosper for a long time. Ananda, have you heard that the Vajjians respect the ancient shrines and take care of holy places and take care to provide for holy people so they can have sages living in their realm? Yes, they do. A people who does this can be expected to prosper and survive for a long time. So the Buddha gives principles of non-decline. He doesn't say anything about how the Vajjians should resist Ajatasattu's army. And he doesn't say anything about, you know, he doesn't directly say to Ajatasattu's minister that invading is wrong. He gives a general principle. And each of the stories that we have in the canon for the Buddha engaging in political talk with kings has him doing similar things like this. He'll give the general principle and then he lets it rest. And the general principle is really based in the law of karma. So this is the law of action and its results. That harmful action bears painful fruit for yourself and others, inevitably, whether sooner or later. And that if we really understand this, particularly if we understand that harmful action bears painful fruit for oneself, one would be motivated not to cause harmful action, not to cause harm. And so the Buddha is really bringing people onto the path. He's not proposing an abstract theory of social justice or social welfare. And so in our circle, one of the things I said was, you know, my personal goals or aims as someone who is interested in, you know, my society having more well-being in it, being less oppressive, being a better place, this world being a better place. some of those aims are like geopolitical. You know, I could have an aim to that the war in Israel end, that the war in Ukraine end, that the wars in Sudan and Congo end, that that the war in Myanmar end. On and on. I have the aim that there's less violence in Oakland, one of my hometowns. You know, I have the aim that there's less of a host of violent, painful things. The tactics that lead to the end of those very, relative goals have to be attuned to those goals. You know, again, it's not for me, from my comfortable, mixed race but lots of white privilege perch in Northern California, to cast judgment on the Black Panthers, whose neighborhood I lived in Oakland, for their role in the civil rights era, being the ones at times to carry guns, to hold a position in the civil rights movement different from the position of the nonviolent resistors. It's not my place, partly because of who I am, and partly because, again, this teaching on nonviolence being the sibling to renunciation. This is a distinct teaching that is related to the goal of liberating the heart from suffering, and part of what I do as a socially progressive, politically engaged person in this moment is I feel the tension between my personal religious approach to nonviolence, where I'm really working to orient my heart toward this deeper renunciation in a kind of existential way toward liberation, as the Buddha describes it, and the, in a certain way, short-term tactics of social justice, where sometimes I don't see nonviolence as the most effective tactic in the relative way. Like, I can see other tactics being helpful. And just to be honest, this creates tension in my heart. Like, this is just difficult to hold, for the reason I said last week that I don't always know. I don't feel like, I'm not always confident, when I'm choosing tactics in relation to social action or social justice. I always feel like I need to know a lot of context. I need to talk to people. It's deep to choose a more forceful resistance. What I do is I respect those who choose it, because I can see how conditions lead to that feeling like the only appropriate response. And I don't think it's for me to judge that it's not an appropriate response. Right? So I think that's just partly where the Buddha sits. He doesn't condemn Ajatasattu for being a warmongering, father-murdering king. He sees him clearly, and when Ajatasattu comes to him and says, at the end of a long, beautiful Dharma talk, Digha-Nikaya 2, the fruits of the ascetic life, he says to the Buddha, the Buddha's just given him this beautiful talk on the whole path, all of the fruits of the holy life, and Ajatasattu says, "Blessed one, I was wrong. My heart was confused. I was lost in greed and delusion, such that I could kill my own father for the sake of the kingship." And the Buddha says, "It is good in the holy life to admit one's faults and make an intention to be better in the future." In Christian language, we would say he forgives him. He doesn't need to forgive him. The karmic action of being accountable is part of what that does it itself. That is the response to what Ajatasattu did, and his karma will continue to unfold, you know, and his practice will continue to unfold. So this word ceasefire, just another couple of minutes on that, and then we'll open to some discussion. This word ceasefire, you know, so in the abstract way, you know, I think the position is in a way obvious, right? Ceasefire is the heart of nonviolence, right? Immediately, always, everywhere is for one who wants their heart to be free, you know, blowing out, extinguishing the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion is the way that the Dhamma proposes. Right? In the Buddha's third discourse, it's called Burning. The Buddha is at Nirgaya, where he was liberated. He's with the first 1,000 monks. And he says famously, monks, the all is burning. Everything is burning. What is it burning with? The fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, what's burning? The eye is burning, the ear is burning, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind are burning. And so, you know, and then the metaphor for nirvana, the going out, is the extinguishing of a flame. So ceasefire is liberation. But ceasefire, in the way that we use it for a war, it actually means you still want to be fighting. Like the conflict that's fueling this is not over. The argument hasn't been solved. What to do with the land has not been solved. You override your impulse to keep fighting because the harms are too great. And so ceasefire is a demand that says stop, that says do a little renunciation. Renunciation means you have an impulse and you're not acting on it. So don't act on that impulse to keep fighting. Stop for a minute or for 2 weeks or for as long as you can, you know, permanently if you can. And I think here is where there can be a little opening, where a war can end. And there are examples of this. A war can end when everyone involved recognizes that it's so harmful and painful to keep going, that it's better to find the compromise, right? And it can end without a distinct victor. There can just be the kind of enough. There's just been enough, and everyone's heart is broken at where this has gone. And renunciation arises whenever anyone, and particularly folks in power, can say, I'm willing to stop. I'm willing to let go of getting more of what I want because the harm is just too great. I can't bear it anymore. And so the call for ceasefire is a, you know, it's a hint toward the liberation of the heart. And as a, you know, as a political, you know, football in a complex moment, it's actually much more limited. It's like, okay, we're going to try to find, we're trying to negotiate for this, and may it be so. But really thinking about this more deeply, to just hold that, you know, the surface level ceasefire is only the barest beginning. But where this points is that it has to point toward a reckoning with things that are very difficult to reckon with. You know, the desire for land, the desire for security, the identifying oneself as a member of a group that makes an exclusion where there's another group, and the way that when tribal affinity grows strong, empathy for those outside that tribal affinity weakens, right? So the lives of my people become more important than the lives of another group of people. I think what's profound about the Buddha's approach is not just that it leads toward this radical inclusivity, right? Radical compassion destroys borders and identities. if you really care about the lives of everybody, it's much, much harder to take sides in a conflict. It's much harder to succumb to any of the worldviews that tell you that this group of people's lives are more important than this group of people's lives. What you do from that as a tactic, I think, you know, has to be attuned to the moment that, to the very moment that you're in. And you know, I would never propose that nonviolence is a universally skillful tactic if my goal is to stop a war, right? It's clearly a wonderful tactic at times in a toolbox of other tactics. But from the perspective of, you know, extinguishing the fire in the heart that the Buddha points to when he says the eye is burning, you know, the ear is burning, burning with greed, with hatred, with delusion. In the context of putting out that fire, it's not just that nonviolence is the best tactic, but nonviolence in a certain way is the entire path, right? Because you set down the willingness to follow any impulse that's going to hurt someone else. And this arises out of the realization that this is the path to liberating one's own heart. And you can only liberate your own heart. You can liberate other people's land, you know, and property. But the liberation of the heart has to be done, you know, one heart at a time. You know, even as we share the path together in community. So there's a bit on ceasefire. And it's good to go and read the burning text. So this is Sangyuta 3528. Linked discourses 3528 is the everything is burning. And we'll pause there. So thank you.